another man's words as a springboard into my own. That man is Dr. Bruno Bettelheim, and he is professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Chicago. Dr. Bettelheim is a man of sometimes of rather Germanic intellectual arrogance. But he is always a man who is incisive and whose ideas must be considered. Recently, he wrote a piece which he entitled Redundant Youth, in which he came to grips with some of the problems involving rebelliousness, revolt in the younger generation. He began this article by citing a number of case histories. One that I recall is of a 25-year-old, highly intelligent, well-trained intellectually, American, young man of Jewish background, a man by the name of Marshall Bloom, who in 1967, at the age of 23, was the instigator of the boycott of classes at the London School of Economics. He was sent down from that school for these activities, returned to New York, where he founded what he called the Liberation News Service, which was designed to be a national news gathering agency to provide information not available through the establishment wire services, United Press International, the New York Times Service, and the like. There was very quickly an office editorial schism within this group, and he founded another similar news service. And when that in time broke up, he went to Massachusetts. He lived for a while on a farming commune there. And there was some difficulty within that commune. And a year ago, some morning in October, he was found in the passenger compartment of his car. He had turned the exhaust through the floorboards into the car and was pouring in carbon monoxide. He had committed suicide. Now, Dr. Bettelheim does not claim that any of the activities of this young man or of the other cases which he cites were not honestly motivated, not a response to their integrity, to a highly sensitive conscience, sense of morality. Rather, he claims that they evidence the fact that it is wrong, foolish, to take the verbal justifications of a cause at their face value. That these young men and young women have many causes which are just. He does not deny the justice of much of what they do, but that to understand why they do it with the intensity with which it is done, why the frenzy, the fervor of the involvement, we must understand something of the churning within. We must understand something of the deeper psychological forces at work. Only then will this pattern become meaningful to us. But he says, in so doing, we must never forget the objective reality. He does not deny that Mr. Blum had reasons to organize a boycott of classes at the London School of Economics, nor does he deny the objective value of much of the criticism of higher education in the United States. He does not deny the value of other alternative sources of news gathering beyond those which are highly professionalized, which have obviously compromised in many cases. He does not deny the value of having communes and groups of this kind trying to form community within the counterculture. What he does deny, what he does claim to be foolish, is the kind of reaction which you and I have seen among many of our friends and neighbors, where an adult listens to the intense justification of a young person's cause and nods his head in instant agreement. What you say makes sense. Go to it. Do your worst. Because the worst is often fatal to the institution, and worse, fatal to the individual who is involved. What Dr. Bettelheim is saying here is that many of our young people come through the early years of adolescence into their late teens and early 20s without having resolved the identity crisis which all of us have had to go through or still have to go through. He claims that there is churning within the breast a great deal of unsolved personal problems, which our society encourages the young person to project out onto the world beyond. In a more rigid society, a young person who cannot find himself, who cannot adjust to his role, who cannot describe his role, who cannot answer the question, who am I? What are the limits of my character? What is my integrity? Such a young person is forced by the very obstinate quality of the society to look at himself, to hold a mirror up into himself, and to describe his own features, all the warts, all the acne, all that goes with youth, as well as the charm, the grace, the talent that lies therein. But in our society, we are so conscious of the evils of the social structure, we are so conscious of the wrongs of every given institution, that a young person is encouraged by the media, by his family, by his community, by his neighbors, not to speak of his own peer group. He is encouraged to take all of this churning energy, this anger, this frustration, this aggression, and to pour it out against the institution, against the establishment, against the family, and to say, you have made me the inadequate person that I am. It is because of you, because of your callousness, because of your coldness, because of your cruelty, because of your cancerous nature, that I am unable to find peace with myself. The fault is yours, not mine. And therefore, I feel totally justified in reacting with violent anger, with bitterness, with cause, to join in common cause with those who agree with me to try pull down, tear down, rip up the institutions which have conditioned me, made me the inadequate person that I think I am. Put another way, many young people who in a more formal social structure would have been forced to come to grips with their own inadequacies and their own limitations are encouraged to deny these time and again, to pour out their frustrations into a holy crusade. But the inadequacy remains. The limitation is still there. And the night of silence, the night of terror, cannot ultimately be postponed. There is a moment when one must say to oneself, this is what I look like. This is a description of the kind of person I really am. I have not come to grips. I am not self-disciplined. Yes, I complain that there is not enough opportunity, but I have not been disciplined enough to take advantage of the opportunity that is there. Yes, I complain about the nature of freedom in our society, but I have not responded sufficiently as a disciplined person, conscious of duty, conscious of responsibility. Bettelheim comments on the fact, which many of us have observed, but which he as a scientist seeks to understand, that so many of the crusades have such a short lifespan. One month we have the crusade about race, and the next month we have a crusade about civil liberties, and the next month we have a crusade about the election, and the next month we have a crusade on ecology. Each one comes to a fervor pitch and then quickly dissipates, though the objective reality indicates that the cause has not yet been won. There is still the smog in the air. There are still those who we do not want in public office. There are still racist elements deep within the social structure. What is it that makes so many of the crusades, so many of the institutions which the counterculture creates, so short-lived? Why do they themselves describe so many of their institutions as ad hoc committees, expecting them to be temporary, to be uncertain, to have a marginal lifespan? The answer Burke Bettelheim comes to is that so many of the young people who form, who man, and who staff these institutions are themselves as yet unstable human beings, not having resolved their internal problems, not having come to grips with themselves. They cannot root themselves to a single issue. They cannot live without constantly posturing, talking about their integrity, about not being able to make any compromises whatsoever. even with those who are on the same wavelength, who have the same lifestyle, who espouse the same causes. There is constant heretical heresy, orthodoxy tension. There's a constant conflict, even among their own revolutionary groups. And Dr. Bettelheim lays this to the unresolved personal tensions which are at work deep within the souls of these young people, which they have not been forced to resolve because the society has made it too easy for them to appear as self-righteous, righteous crusaders, as people with a holy cause who must not be questioned because their cause is holy. Dr. Bettelheim, along the way, has many unkind things to say about the homes from which these young people come from, and they are our homes, upper middle class, suburban. He does not use the word Jewish, but I suspect an inordinate number of them are. Study after study has shown that many of these young people, a disproportionate number of them, come from liberal homes, liberal politically, liberal socially, liberal religiously. And we've tried to understand why. One would think that the intense rebel would come from a home where he was intensely repressed. But it seems that he comes from a home where he was understood, where he was encouraged, where many of his ideas found common ground. One of the answers which is often given is that these young people simply are taking one step farther, the table talk, the verbal liberalism of their parents, but they are taking into action what their parents only put into words. Dr. Bettelheim is not satisfied with that explanation. He feels that the problem lies deeper. It lies in the fact that in many of our homes, we have what he calls a conventional Freudian wisdom, by which he means we don't know what we're talking about. And by this conventional Freudian wisdom, he means, we have understood from psychology and psychiatry that repression is evil, that repression can distort personality, that repression can prevent the talents of a young person from budding, from coming to flower. And therefore, we have said to ourselves, we must never take the child during his temper tantrum and shake him out of it. We must never take the most malicious, the most unconsciously violent words of a young person and say to him, you have no right to speak these. These are not appropriate. We have never told him that he cannot have his emotional sway over the home, that it's a place of adults, because we fear somehow to restrict him, to put him into an emotional straitjacket, to distort his growth. And as a result, to use the psychological terms, we have never helped him to develop his superego, the conscience, that iron wall that comes down on us when we are tempted to say what we know we ought not say. When we are tempted to act in an aggressive way that is inappropriate to the situation at hand. And more than this, Bettelheim says, not only has the home encouraged the childishness, the temper tantrum, the lack of a conscience, the lack of development of a superego, but the home has projected into the entire world of which the child is a part, this very attitude. And so when he leaves the home, he is not likely to be repressed, to meet up against someone who will say to him, you can't say that to me. If a child goes to his school, or is out in the street and he sees a teacher or he sees a policeman and he gives vent to his anger and he calls him a name and the policeman or the teacher in anger slaps the child, we have created a society in which that teacher or that policeman will lose their job. Rather than saying to ourselves, perhaps this is a lesson the child needs to learn. And if a child goes and he gets a vacation employment and he doesn't like the way the employer is running the business, and he goes into the employer's office and he tells him off. He comes home, we say, well, it was probably good for the employer's soul and there are always other jobs and you have your integrity. I'm glad you stood up and spoke out. But in effect, what we are doing is to deny the young person, a child, a chance during the formative years of developing an effective emotional structure which will be a discipline to him, a control for him, which will allow him to live successfully in the real world, in the world where there are no over-solicitous parents to protect you from all evil. And therefore, when he comes out into that world, he doesn't have the control. He lets go, and he feels that he is accomplishing, that he is being himself, when in fact he is, according to Bettelheim, simply running away from his own unresolved problems. Now, all this seems to me to have a good bit of good sense to it. Some of these things I've said to you before in other ways, drawn from theology and the wisdom of our faith rather than from psychiatry, which is not my field. Some of it is indicated in the Torah portion we read this morning. Joseph was a 17-year-old. Joseph was an adolescent whose father and mother had obviously not built into him the controls and not created in the home the stress situations which would have allowed Joseph to recognize that you can't go about saying how great I am. I know best. Now, his father didn't get angry at anything that Joseph did until Joseph began to say, I know more than you do, Father. You're the sun and the moon and the stars who bow down to me in my dream. And then the father got angry for a moment, and then he promptly forgot his anger. Now, Joseph did not commit suicide, but he almost did. He got his brothers, who were the workers, the hard hats of the day, so angry with him that they sold him into slavery, into a living death. And only good fortune, or as the Bible would have it, God's providence, saved him from that fate. We consign our young people to a kind of living death if we do not give them during their growing up years the chance to come to grips with themselves, if we do not force them through their identity crisis before they begin to spew out their frustration, their anger, their aggression, all that churns within on the institutions of the outside world. Now, all this is of interest, but it's essentially an aside in Bettelheim's article which suggests to me what I'd like to say to you this morning. Bettelheim asks an interesting question. He asks, why is it that these young people have made the United States of America the bec noir of so much of their ideology? Why is it that it is the American society which is imperialist and repressive and cruel and racist and evil? We have no monopoly on repression and on imperialism and on cruelty and on racism and on evil. As a matter of fact, one can objectively make the case that the Soviet Union has at least as much imperialism in her foreign policy, has far more repression of intellectuals, of youth within the social structure. A Nobel Prize winner of this year is being vilified in the Soviet Union at the moment. This evening, the Jews of Cleveland, during the weeks ahead, Jews all over America will come together, young Jews and old, to protest what is obviously an anti-Semitic show trial in Leningrad within the Soviet Union, sponsored by all of the public relations media of the Soviet press. The director of external relations of propaganda, a woman of the Soviet Union, said only the day before yesterday in the public press, that if the Jews in the Soviet reacted as the Jews in the United States have reacted to this show trial, she would know how to handle them. The control is obvious, it's spoken of, it's not hidden. And yet somehow it is the United States, where freedom is relatively unbounded, where abundance has very few limits. It is the United States which is the focus, the devil, which plays this role in this thing. And he asks why. If one cannot find the answer in objective reality, he suggests one finds it in a psychological reality. And he suggests that the United States plays the role that it does in these ideologies because the United States represents the future danger. In the United States, technology has come closest to its ultimate triumph. And when it triumphs, youth becomes redundant. Who wants to make it anymore in America? one of the youth leaders said. What great, glorious achievements remain to be achieved? What does the society need of me? How often has the young person been told that he must go to school not so much to learn, not because it is a meaningful growing experience, but simply because he has to be kept out of the laboring force another 4 or 6 or 8 years. The young person, Bettelheim says, in America feels himself to be irrelevant to the social structure. He is not needed for the good of the social order. Occasionally you can rally his energies for a Peace Corps, for a VISTA program. The minute you show him need, he responds. But for the average young person, there is no clear need. And the young person responds, as does anyone who does not feel that he is necessary and important and significant, by turning against, by tuning out, by turning off. Now the question I want to ask is this psychological reality to many of our young people, in fact, the reality for most of us? Is man obsolete? Are we superfluous? Are we redundant, unnecessary in the society of the computer, in the society of the triumph of technology, in the society where one doesn't have to work by the sweat of one's brow? 2 generations ago, a man worked from the 6th grade to the day before he went into the hospital for his fatal illness. A generation ago, a man worked from graduation from high school till he was 65 or 70. The unions today are working for what they call a program of 30 and out. 30 years of 4-day-a-week employment, and then one has completed one's necessary occupational responsibility. One qualifies for the pension. We retired at 70, 65, 62, 60. We entered employment at 16, 18, 20, 22, 25. Man, obviously, his place is no longer described by the work that he does. Most of what we do is, in fact, not as a homo faber, as a working man, as a productive unit, as a workhorse. Well, are we then obsolete? Are we necessary? Someone has said that what justifies to a man his own existence is a sense of participation in a glorious and shining cause. What cause do we have in a society where, God willing, there will be peace, where economically and technologically we have shattered the old industrial problems and have created abundance? What glorious and shining responsibilities remain for us to achieve? What justifies our lives to us? I read recently of a series of scholars and academics who met to discuss what they called utopia, the dream, the description, the architecture of the world that is emerging, that is to be. Now, one would think that a utopianist, I discover there is such an academic specialty, that a utopianist would be a very happy man. All he has to do is to dream about Vermont, clean snow, clean air, beautiful cities, happy people, people who have nothing but leisure, time on their hands, who are able to do what they feel they need to do. But you know, I read through these papers, and these are bitterly unhappy human beings. Their talk is gray. They haven't the vaguest idea, any of them, how man will live when he doesn't have to work by the sweat of his brow. They haven't the vaguest idea what man will do with himself when he is burdened with free time. They talk of free time as a burden. It lays heavy on one's hand, and it can. Some of you who are retired know that it does. They wonder, what will fill man's mind, his spirit? What will encourage him to get up with some gusto every day if he has nothing but nothing to do, no accomplishments, no shining, glorious accomplishments to match? And as I read these articles, I felt glad that there was employment for these men, that they had something to do. But I felt that they really had overlooked the one great historical model of an obsolete society. For there has been a society of superfluous men, and it has survived with dignity, and has survived with a sense of personal worth and a sense of community for many centuries. I refer, of course, to the ghetto society of Jews in Europe. They were obsolete. They were declared so by the environment. No one wanted any part of them. They were not asked to join Sir Lancelot and Sir Gawain and the other knights in deeds of derring do. They were not wanted in the armies. They were not invited by the Bismarcks and the Metternichs to join in the business of government, deeds of glory and derring do. No one wanted them in government. They were not invited to the great academic centers to join in the universities. They were ostracized, denied admission. No one wanted them as part of the great intellectual shining achievement, the glory of intellectual life. They were not invited to be part of the community and planning on a city level for the future of that community. They were ostracized, social outcasts, parias, superfluous, redundant, obsolete men. And yet for all of that, though they lived locked in, though they lived in a world which perforce was turned in on itself, they lived with dignity, they lived with equality, they lived with a fine sense of personal worth. How did they manage it? In the first instance, by prizing learning, by prizing the world of the intellect, by prizing ideas. If you can think free men's thoughts, you don't have to project yourself physically to a given space. You don't have even physically to be free. You debate these ideas within whatever context you find yourself. Their world was the world of books. And they went back in time and ahead in time, down and up and down the time tunnel, from Israel to the Messianic Age, debating, describing, defining, enjoying one another's intellectual acumen, learning to live with one another, which is actually the skill which any society of obsolete men must magnify. And for those who were not that bright, who were simply not that intelligent, there were all kinds of cooperative ventures, groups which met in every community to take care of the sick, to provide for the poor, to welcome the wayfarer, to provide a hospice and a hospital for those who were elderly. All of these activities were performed in human relationship. Men learned in the society to live in the world up here and to share the world that is in here. And those are the arts, I think, which a utopian society or an outcast society, and they're the same thing, really, that these kinds of societies must develop. We must learn to live without the sense of adventure, without the feeling that we fulfill ourselves only if we can become immortal by being the first to step upon a new continent or upon a new planet, by being the first to uncover one of the secrets of the universe. Almost all that we do in the work that remains to be done, and much more work remains to be done than the Bettelheims, the utopianists, yet admit. All that we do will, however, be done cooperatively. We went to the moon, not one man, not three men alone, but millions of men hours were invested in the mathematics, in the computation, in the astronomy, in the engineering of the craft which went out into space. We are now members of a group society. Scholarship is today a group accomplishment. How many of the men who win the prizes for scholarly achievement, for medical research, are part of groups, large numbers of men who work together, who share the adventure in a single laboratory. And so it is that in this new world which emerges, though we may be redundant in terms of finding the Holy Grail, we are not redundant if we make our goals, the goals of defining, describing the arts of interpersonal relationship, of learning to live in community, of learning to share the adventure of life, of learning to share the questions and the decisions of policy which confront all of us. In this world of the ghetto, the Jews turned Moses, the great, strong liberator, the man who bearded Pharaoh in his palace, the man who by iron will led the Jews for 40 years, led a recalcitrant ex-slave people for 40 years through the wilderness, they turned Moses into Moshe Rabbeinu, into Moses with a yarmulke on his head, Moses our rabbi, teaching Talmud to a group of scholars around a table. But we need, really, a is to turn the great heroes which we place before us, and particularly which we place before our children, from the heroes of space, from the heroes who go after la gloire, glory, to the heroes of the mind, to the heroes of the spirit. We need heroes. Let's make an Albert Einstein into a hero. Let's make a Gandhi into a hero. Let's make the men who look within, who understand their own souls and how to relate to others, and somehow out of unique talent and unique spirit, bring great accomplishment to our world. Men who do not wear the scabbard on their belt. Men who do not keep the fists clenched, ready to strike out in bold adventure. Man may be obsolete in the sense that he is not needed to push the heavy weights which move the instruments of production. But man is not obsolete if we look at the jobs that remain to be done. We must take this accumulative people, I hesitate to call it a society or a community, the vast hundreds of millions, the billions of earthlings, and somehow give to our cities, give to our societies, give to our families integrity, give them direction, give them a sense of quality. We must learn the arts of living. And in that, I submit, there is work aplenty, all of us and our children and our children's children, unto all the generations. Amen.